Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the long war. Today, my co-host is my friend and colleague at the Lone War Journal, Caleb Weiss. Caleb is a senior analyst at the Bridgeway Foundation, as well as my co-editor at the Lone War Journal. His breadth and depth of knowledge on Al-Qaeda, particularly in Africa, but beyond, is fantastic. Caleb, great to have you back co-hosting Generation Jihad.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Yeah, always good to be back.
We really do got to get back into a rhythm. It's just been so crazy with the war, with what's happening in the Middle East right now. And, you know, I kind of lament that the terrorist issues, the jihadist issues are getting short shrift, and yet I'm guilty of it myself. But it's, you know, it's just difficult to focus on all these issues. But that's why, you know, we made the effort today, and we're going to make a better effort going forward to get these issues on the burner, because there's, you know, there's so much to talk about. The attack in Moscow, what's going on in Somalia, the reported death of Saif al-Adel's son in Yemen, what recently happened in Afghanistan between the Taliban and Pakistan. And that's what we're going to cover today. And there's so much that we're leaving on the cutting floor. But let's get started, Caleb. We'll start off with the Islamic State's attack in Moscow. This type of attack, by the way, is something that really concerns me. Just getting guys with guns and going into crowded spaces that are poorly secured. I got to tell you, you know, I don't think it's a secret at this point. If I was a terrorist leader, this is how I would organize my attacks in the West, because the West is very prone to these type of attacks. So what did they do? They got four guys with guns. They went into a theater in Moscow. The theater had 6,200 people. The security guards didn't have firearms, which is absolutely stunning. You would think in a semi-police state like Russia that, you know, thinks venues like these would be locked down. But, you know, one of the things the terrorists are good at is finding, you know, the seams in these. They also reportedly used some type of explosive device. They may have been like petrol bombs. It's a little unclear on that. Over 140 people killed, hundreds wounded. I've read that they're saying 95 people missing. I'm not sure how that's possible, but it's possible that just people fled the scene and just made themselves scarce. Who knows? The Islamic State claimed credit for the attack. Russian authorities detained four Tajiks. Here we are. Caleb, let's get into it. What is the Islamic State's motivation for conducting an attack like this at this time?
Well, I mean, I was going to interrupt you earlier, but you had a nice flow going, so I let you go. But it's really eerily reminiscent to me of the Bataclan attack in Paris during the Paris attack. So, again,
Caleb, I apologize for any, I was thinking that with a little mix of Mumbai, right? Like a downsized Mumbai was the vibe I got on that attack.
Which is like crazy, because Mumbai was, what, 2008, Bataclan 2015. So, 10 years later. We haven't learned anything, the world, that is, of something like the Bataclan, of this crowded, packed music venue with limited security. Again, happened again in Russia. It's just very interesting to me that terrorists, jihadists, whatever, are still able to kind of replicate that model and replicate it successfully. It's insane to me. But secondly, on the motivation, this is like the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard.
I concur, Caleb. I can't believe we have to ask you this question, but here we are.
What's the motivation? One, the Islamic State hates everybody. If you don't agree with their version of Islam, you're a kuffar. You should die, is their belief. Secondly, let's look at it more, I don't know, realistically. Russia has had a long history of fighting jihadis. I mean, they fought them in Chechnya, fought them nominally in Syria. They're fighting them now currently in Mali and Burkina. They fought them in Mozambique, and in Mali, Burkina, and Mozambique, they were fighting the Islamic State itself, and, you know, again, nominally in Syria. So it's like, what do you mean? What was the motivation? They had all the motivation in the world of this massive state that is actively fighting their forces around the world. Not to mention, you know, leveling Grozny, a Muslim city in Chechnya in the 90s that has had longstanding, you know, importance for jihadis. against Russia. You know, and this is something, shout out to Lucas Weber at Militant Wire. He's done a good job of kind of tracking Islamic State Khorasan province propaganda. Russia has been a long-standing target in ISKP's propaganda. So those who are asking, you know, what was the motivation? Why would they do this? You're just not paying attention, dude. Like, it's as simple as that.
Yeah. Dare we go back further? Afghanistan and the invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. I mean, it runs deep. The Russian territory and former republics are part of what Al-Qaeda, what the Islamic State wants to incorporate into their caliphate. It's their enemies. As you said, the Islamic State views everyone and anyone who doesn't disagree with them. It's their way or the highway, right? That's the way I describe the Islamic State when comparing them to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda's big tent will work with you. Islamic State, my way or the highway. They're going after everyone. But now that's not to say Al-Qaeda wouldn't attack Russia. It had the means and the opportunity to do so and the desire to do so. You know, you had said something pretty, you know, that when you said, right, Mumbai 2008, Bhattacharya 2015, right? You know, this is how they operate. They operate on World Trade Center in 1993, World Trade Center 2001. They're patient, these groups. They're, you know, so when one of these attacks happen, you know, those who don't pay attention, and, you know, in fairness, I don't expect the average American to understand the ins and outs of this, but certainly experts and people in the media who track this stuff should. And that's why I always get annoyed with the, oh my God, this is shocking. How could they do this? Why would they do this? And the answer is because this is what they do, and because they operate in terms of decades and generations, right? So yeah, they're patient. They could wait 7, 8, 9, 10 years between attacks like these. And meanwhile, there's a lot going on in between.
There's a lot going on. And also, that wasn't as perverse to me as the tweets that were like, oh, the Islamic State suddenly back, or ISIS returns as Israel's killing, you know, Gazans. First of all, unrelated. Second of all, they never left, dude. There was one famous writer, I should say, at CNN, who wrote an article called ISIS's Comeback After the Moscow Attack. They never left, bro. Like, what do you mean comeback?
We call it ebbs and flows, right? The ups and downs of the jihad. They're prominent, then they get, you know, they might take one on the chin, but they don't go anywhere. You know, Caleb, you had a great tweet on that, and I followed that up with we've seen this with Al-Qaeda's back. Like, go ahead, I challenge anyone, go Google Al-Qaeda's return, Al-Qaeda resurgence, whatever. And then one of my favorites was the Taliban is tired. I remember I think I wrote this up in somewhat sarcastically. You know, the trope was the Taliban was tired, and you could Google articles, just Google tired Taliban. You'll get articles back from 2003. And, you know, my joke is they're so tired, they took over a country, and I'd hate to see what would happen if they were well rested. So this, yeah, it is a little bit maddening, but I guess that's what happens. And Caleb, by the way, this is the same reason why I won't watch movies in our field, because it's just so frustrating to watch these things and go, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong.
Little inside baseball for the listeners. We had an idea once of having
I'm not done with this idea. We're going to do this one day. Go ahead.
We're going to do a review podcast of these movies.
Maybe right now, boy, finding the time is going to be difficult. But yeah, we would love to review movies in our field and say, you know what, there's good ones out there, and there's good parts of these movies, and there's flaws. But yeah, a lot of my friends always are like, oh, did you see... And Caleb laughs at me, and so does our producer Danielle. Like, I haven't seen Zero Dark 30. Okay, I admit it, I haven't. All right, I feel like I already seen the movie. But anyway, well, I digress.
So one last point, I guess, on this before I move on is, you know, in addition to just dunking on people with surprise that, you know, these long stays coming back or whatever, it's just, you know, as someone who focuses on Africa, it's especially frustrating of, you're writing these articles now about their comeback, but they've controlled an entire province of Mali for pretty much almost a year now. No articles written about that, about their comeback, that they have an actual governance structure, you know, whatever. But no, that doesn't constitute a comeback, I guess. It's only when, you know, quote unquote, you know, long-term respected analysts finally pay attention again that they make a comeback.
And they're forced to pay attention because an attack of that magnitude can't just be ignored. It can't be downplayed.
Yeah. And you know, I don't want to be a rant, but, you know, there's the whole historical legacy of not caring about what happens in Africa.
Well, so. And you know what I always say with Western attitudes towards Africa is literal just policy too, is fuck Africa. I mean, that's how they treat it. It's only an issue when American soldiers are killed in Niger by the Islamic State in a counter, or U.S. soldiers killed in Somalia, you know. something happens that is Western related, it's all Western focused. And I find that ironic. Well, I won't go there, but I'm sure the readers can read ironic. My mind on this one, but I won't touch that.
I mean, it is ironic because, I mean, guess who is doing the bulk of the fighting against the Islamic State today? African forces.
Yep.
They get virtually zero support.
No, none. No, they're, you know, again, it's fuck Africa. And that's all it is. Yeah, it really is frustrating when you're tracking this and you know. And by the way, that's what they develop in Somalia, what they develop in Mali, what they develop in South Asia. It feeds into these attacks. So we shouldn't be shocked when they have networks set up that feed into supporting these attacks. I wouldn't be shocked if that office in Somalia might have played a role in funding this attack, right?
Amazing segue, because I think we should talk about Somalia. Because you're asking, right, it was the U.S. government did say, I think several months ago now, or maybe it was the U.N. I think it was the U.N. actually, in one of their monitoring team reports that the Al-Qarar office in Puntland was funding the Islamic State Khorasan province via cryptocurrency to the tune of like $25,000 a month, which is absurd if that's even, you know, remotely true or even half true. It's a lot of money. That's a lot of money to fund a lot of things.
It sure is. And before we turn to Somalia, I want to just discuss both sides of the conspiracy theory with respect to Moscow. I hate conspiracy theories and I hate talking about them, but I do think that it's important that they be somewhat debunked here. One of the theories I heard from some very credible theory people, or people who I used to think were credible anyway, was that this attack was executed by Putin in order to inflame, you know, given, you know, to pin it on Ukraine and inflame the war somehow. Now, this doesn't, I just find this absolutely absurd. Prior to this attack, Putin, quote, won his, quote, election, right? But that's done. So he has a mandate. There is very little resistance, little to no resistance within Russia to Putin's war in Ukraine. And, you know, if you do, you know, is his purpose to, you know, kill Russian elite in order to garner support? It just doesn't make sense from that side of it. You know, Putin is not having recruiting problems for the Russian military. He's having battlefield success on the front lines right now. Ukraine is having problems. So, you know, these conspiracy theories just take away agency from these terrorist organizations who do often act on their own. And then on the flip side, you know, you have the Russians, you have Russian officials. Now, some of this, I think, is being manipulated by the media to make it sound like the Russians are accusing only Ukraine of carrying out an attack. But there has been officials that have said, you know, that have pointed the finger that Ukraine is behind. But a lot of what they're saying is that now the Tajiks were reportedly detained while traveling towards Ukraine. We know that Ukraine is a country where corruption is rampant, particularly in a time of war. It's possible that crypto that we're talking about, that illicit networks can operate from Ukraine. There are jihadists that do operate from Ukraine. This was written about before the war, but was buried. There's jihadists that operate in all, you know, in a lot of Western countries. Anyway, I just, robbing the Islamic State of agency and making this attack a tool of either the West or of Russia is just a really bad idea if you want to prevent an attack like this from occurring again. Your thoughts, Caleb?
It's clear the Islamic State did it. Pointing out or trying to point the finger at Ukraine is just Russian diversion away from their lack of security or their lack of any sort of cohesive policy that would have thwarted this attack. It's all nonsense. It was the Islamic State saying it's not. Is you're just putting, you know, your hands over your eyes and pretending like it didn't happen. They have agency. They get to make their own decisions. What's the famous quote? The enemy gets to vote. Sort of the same thing of the Islamic State gets to say in sort of what happened. And they have the receipts. They've released claims. They've released the video. It's very clear that it was them.
Yeah. And then people, well, that's just the Russians might say that's just a Ukrainian op or the flip side. And it's just, you know, the internet has given the rise of conspiracy theories. It's just out of control. You just can't not come across them daily. Just try to ignore them. Let's move on to Somalia. Give us an update. What is happening in Somalia? What's the state there? How is the Somali government doing? What is Shabaab's reaction to its offensive? Has that offensive stalled? Give us a rundown.
Fence has stalled. Not only stalled, but in reverse. Shabab is kind of taking back a lot of the areas in the center, this region called Mudug, where the original counteroffensive against Shabab that started a year and a half ago started. A lot of those areas, not all of them, but the majority of the areas that were originally retaken from Shabab have now been taken back by Shabab. And then a few were changing hands basically every day. But in addition to kind of taking back territory in Mudug, you're seeing a lot of Shabab attacks elsewhere, middle, lower Shabelle, Jubaland, and Gedo against Ethiopians. They're attacking, you know, remaining African Union forces. They're attacking Somali National Army bases, SNA. So when the African Union forces hand over a base to the SNA, Shabab has made a point to try to attack that base soon after, sort of either probing to see what they could actually do, or if they know they could overrun it, they've been overrunning them. And this is sort of a sad state of affairs right now of Somalia kind of pretending that this counteroffensive is still going or still going strong when it's not. And for the last year or more, they've been talking about a so-called phase two, which is supposed to happen in southern Somalia, but that's, you know, dead in the water at this point. It's not going to happen. So Shabab is just rampaging right now and taking back a lot of territory that they initially lost. And it's not good. So something that you and I have talked about a lot of, you know, part of the problem of why this is, you know, twofold. One, they can't hold territory that well, the SNA. They're primarily relying on clan-based militias called the Ma'awisli. And the Ma'awisli are, just these clan-based militias that are loyal to the state, that, you know, sort of have their own inherent problems. But for whatever reason, the SNA and the federal government of Somalia and Mogadishu have made a point to, the SNA will sort of clear out areas, or they did clear out areas, and then these Ma'awisli fighters are supposed to hold it. Not doing so well at this point. In other areas, the SNA themselves held areas, but again, those are falling at this point. And then secondly, the bulk of the fighting, the main force that is actually kind of going after Shabab is Danab, which Danab is this U.S. trained special forces group that was originally built around CT, counterterrorism, and now they're sort of being in a counterinsurgency role. And this is, you know, I don't want to steal your spotlight here, but this is something Bill has talked about a lot of. It's very similar to what happened in Afghanistan, of these Afghan commandos that were, again, trained for CT by the U.S., but used in a counterinsurgency role. And then we're seeing that sort of same model happening in Somalia, which, again, if you want to take a lesson from Afghanistan, does not spell anything good for Somalia.
Caleb, you are free to steal my thunder any day of the week. Yes, that's absolutely. I'm getting a serious Afghanistan vibe when it comes to Danab. Right now, we're seeing American officials pumping up Danab as being the answer. But we learned, I mean, Afghanistan had tens of thousands of well-trained commandos and special forces and special police units that were very, very capable. But A, they were misused.
I'm sorry, you said tens of thousands?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, Danab is working nowhere close to that, which is a key factor.
You know, I mean, smaller country, however, you know, demographically, however, you know, yeah, and I'm combining the commandos, the special forces, and then there was a host of these special police units that were some CIA-backed or some, you know, call it militias, whatever you want to call them. But when you combine them, they were very capable, very well-trained units, but they were being misused, being put in, you know, securing district centers in Afghanistan. Fighting open battles against the Taliban when they were trained as counterterrorism, you know, knock on door type forces. And I'm getting that feeling in Somalia right now. And it's like you said, we're not learning the lessons. This is my complaint with everything, with the lack of accountability in Afghanistan, inability to take the fight to the Houthis, we're just not learning lessons. How we build security forces, you know, I would include Ukraine in that. We tried to equip them with a West. Maybe that wasn't the right equipment we sent them. Maybe the training wasn't long enough. Maybe we misjudged their effectiveness. This all sounds so familiar when you look at Afghanistan. When you look at Iraq, right? Look at how the Islamic State overran Iraqi security forces that we built for a decade. They destroyed them in the course of a year while taking over northern, central and western Iraq, as well as portions of Syria, which was a lot easier since the Syrian government was a hot mess. But yeah, I'm deeply concerned about this.
Let me be a contrarian real quick. So what are the, of, you know, we phrases in that? The U.S. and Somalia, at this point, I don't even know what we think is going to happen or what we want to happen. Right now, we're operating on such a small footprint that it's just, if the U.S. truly wanted to make a difference in Somalia, they could. What the U.S. is doing now is, you know, 500 or so special, or yeah, U.S. special forces in Somalia, doing these, you know, training and advising or remote training advising where they don't leave the FOBs, and then, you know, occasional drone strikes. None of that is going to make a wider difference in the fight against Shabaab, which controls huge swaths of territory in Somalia, fields tens of thousands of fighters. It's just a very low footprint, and you're operating on essentially a hope and a dream that that's going to be enough to do anything. So at this point, it seems to me that like the U.S. is doing the bare minimum and then hoping for whatever reason that it's going to work. If that rant makes sense, it's just, it's very, to me, it's like, if we're going to try to make a difference in Somalia, or we're going to support Somalia in this fight, do it. Otherwise, what are we doing with these 500 troops and, you know, occasional drone strikes?
Yeah, Caleb, it does make sense. If there is any U.S. Defense Department or State Department official or military official who thinks that what we're doing in Somalia is going to have a positive effect and positive outcome, you need to get your head examined. This is barely keeping a lid on the pot that is beginning to boil over. That is what the mission must be, based on the resources that we provided. And I just, you know, I don't think it's, you know, I think that lid is ready to come off, Caleb.
Yeah, it's, I guess my wider point with that is that, you know, I don't know at this point we could say that, you know, oh, we're trying, or, you know, the U.S. is really trying to make a difference, when they're not. It's just the fact is they're not. And if they really wanted to, they would have more resources.
We developed a pattern of trying to tread water in these wars in Afghanistan, right? Minimal force structure, U.S. force structure. By the way, which wasn't based on the mission, but based on troop numbers. Same thing with Somalia, troop numbers. Same thing with Syria and Iraq, troop numbers. We did it in Iraq, right? We did just enough to try to prop up a local government that didn't have the time and space to do what needed to be done to mature. And yeah, this is a major failing. I think it just becomes a sort of policy inertia. I can't really describe what's in my head right now, but we just tread water. We just try to do the same thing and hope things that don't collapse. But unfortunately, what we've learned over the time is that things do tend to collapse. No, you know, look at, again, Iraq. We leave Iraq in 2011. By 2013, the Islamic State, not 2014, 2013, the Islamic State is in control of cities in Western Anbar, Ramadi and Fallujah, long before they took control of Mosul and much of Northern and Central Iraq. You know, obviously Afghanistan, you know, again, we tread water until we didn't want to tread water anymore, and that collapsed quickly. And I think this is, you know, the African Union troops or the ATMIS troops that are in Somalia, if they leave, I think that, you know, we can measure the lifespan of the Somali government in months, possibly a year or two, but that would be quite positive. What are your thoughts, Caleb? I hate to ask people on the line make predictions, but if those African Union troops leave and the U.S. maintains its level of support, what are the prospects for survival for the Somali government?
Probably not good. The African Union forces have definitely been sort of a force multiplier, providing a bulwark against, you know, Shabaab to defend Mogadishu. You know, the SNA is training or trying to train tens of thousands of other soldiers via, you know, Uganda, Qatar, Eritrea, all these different states that are hosting Somali troops for training. I just really don't see it making a difference. The SNA already sort of crumbles when under a large-scale attack against bases. They do a lot of, you know, calculated retreats where they just let Shabaab take over territory. A lot of the SNA is sort of just tribal militias anyway that are loyal for pay. You know, SNA units are constantly fighting each other. So no, like the SNA by itself, I don't see being that effective in holding back Shabab once the African Union forces are gone. You know, even with the U.S.'s limited presence, you do have Turkish presence, which Turkey's also doing drone strikes in Somalia, and they're at this point probably doing more drone strikes than the U.S. With less restrictive ROEs. Not saying that's a good thing. A lot of Turkish drone strikes or suspected Turkish drone strikes do kill civilians. But even with Turkish drone strikes, that's not going to be enough. If the Emiratis actually start doing drone strikes, which allegedly they have, but I've never been able to confirm that. But if the Emiratis start, that's not going to be enough combined with Turkey or the U.S. It's just all of these things are way too limited to actually effectively work. So no, I don't have optimism for once the AU leaves that Somalia will be able to hold back Shabab for that long. And I really, really hope I'm wrong.
I always hope I'm wrong these days, Caleb. Yeah, I mean, look, the thing is these countries are launching attacks now. And again, it's barely keeping a lid on it. So I concur with you.
That's the same argument for Niger, by the way. All these takes of, oh, the U.S. leaving Niger is going to be such a bad thing for U.S. policy. It's going to open the door for Russia. Maybe. But like the main argument against that is, what was the U.S. actually making a difference in to begin with? Of, you had these two drone bases that are normally doing ISR, but like did not prevent the spread of jihadism in the Sahel at all.
In fact, yeah, I would argue some visibility is better than none, but yeah, we're arguing about, you know, the margins here, and that's the reality of what we're talking about. One quick thing you had mentioned too, Caleb, about the training, right? Just look what you said. You have Turkish troops training the SNA, you have Emirati, you have UAE, you have US forces, you have Ugandan. Are you getting what kind of training are we getting? Are we getting uniform training? Is this training that translates from unit to unit?
That's a great question, because there's no way that a US trained force like Danab is going to receive sort of, well, that's maybe a bad example because they're a different unit. So let me use another one. A Qatari trained force is not going to receive the same training as a Ugandan trained force or an Eritrean trained force, because all these militaries operate differently, and they have different skills and different subset of skills that are better than the others. So no, it's not going to be uniform training across the board.
Yeah, that's a bleak outlook for Somalia, and we go back and forth.
And also, just one thing of some of the units that were trained in Eritrea, back when the war in Tigray was going on in sort of northeastern Ethiopia, some of the Somali troops that were being trained in Eritrea, they wound up in Tigray fighting.
Yeah, that's right. Eritrea. I remember you reporting about this, Caleb. Yeah.
So you also have that problem of, they go for training, and then the people that are supposed to train them just use them as mercenaries.
We had that problem in Yemen. I remember when we were backing the former president, Saleh, and, you know, gave him all this equipment and, you know, trained their special forces, and then they turned. And yeah, and he went up defecting to the Houthis. Right.
Eritrean thing was a big scandal. And luckily it's now on top of it, allegedly. But fuck, man, that was pretty embarrassing too.
Yeah, it is. Look at all the coup countries, right, in Africa. All the generals that did it had backing of the U.S. I mean, do we really know what we're doing? Do we really know who we're operating with? Though that's a whole podcast in itself, Caleb. But let's turn real quickly. There's been rumors that Saif al-Adel's son, who is a key leader for al-Qaeda in Yemen, or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to be more specific, has died. A purported picture was circulated on Twitter, but we've had no confirmation. Do you have any information on this, Caleb? I don't expect us to go in an in-depth conversation here, but that's certainly, with the recent death of its previous emir, Ali Batarfi, this would be a pretty big blow to the leadership of al-Qaeda organization in Yemen. I wouldn't say it's the death knell of it. Again, ebbs and flows. We might be a little bit in the ebbing point port here if they did lose two key leaders. But what information do you have on Saif al-Adel's son?
I probably don't have any other information that most other people do. I've also seen the jihadis comment on it and sort of circulate the photo. I don't know. The way that they're saying he died is very weird, that he died in a fire.
Fire? Yeah, that's what I thought it was, it's too. Fire. I can't remember. Yeah, and Batarfi died of some type of sickness, apparently, is what they were reporting as well, right?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's the best answer that I don't know.
Yeah.
Very well could be true. Again, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist because we harped on conspiracy theorists, but it's just, you know, there have been times where jihadis, when they were faced under pressure, faked to death. Abdul Haq al-Turkestani, the leader of the Turkestan Islamic Party, famous for that. When he was injured in a U.S. drone strike to sort of protect him and allow him to heal, the TIP and al-Qaeda said he died, and then came back in full force a few years later. Now, I'm not saying that's what's happening here with Khalid. I don't want to say that at all. But it's just very weird of, you know, in quick succession, within weeks of each other, you have two high-profile leaders in Yemen die of weird circumstances. And also just after everyone was talking about Saif al-Adel's son, because it was reported by the UN that he was there. So it's just weird timing to me. And again, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but it's just, you know, hopefully he is dead. That would be great. But it's just, it's so weird to me.
Yeah, don't be surprised. Look, there's conspiracy theories and then there's theories, right? And this is a possibility. You know, if you would have told me in 2012 the Taliban was going to lie about Mullah Omar's death and play Weekend at Bernie's with them for 2 years by issuing statements in his name,
yeah,
I would have been like, that's a great conspiracy theory you got there. And then yet here we are. So what we're talking about here, Caleb, is there is some precedent that they have played games, particularly, look, if the report was Ghaleb Batarfi died in combat or in a drone strike, and then, you know, Saif al-Adel's son died in some type of combat or a drone strike, I'd be like, yeah, that seems pretty interesting. And that's believable to me. But dying of sickness and dying in a fire, it's just kind of odd, right? And, you know, given the timing and the pressure. So it's a possibility. I'm not going to sit here and say that's the answer. That's what a conspiracy theorist will do. And, you know, say, it's a big cover up. But we're not doing that. We're just putting that out there as a possibility. Go ahead.
No, I mean, that's exactly it. It could be true. Could be fake. I don't know. It's very weird. And if it is true, comes at a bad time for ACAP, because ACAP is sort of on the rise again. You know, so if both these, I'm sure Batarfi is dead. That was sort of commented on by
yes. The
central leadership. It's Saif al-Adel and Khalid that I'm less sure of. But let's say it is true. I mean, ACAP was sort of rebounding, attacking a lot of these southern tribal forces, attacking, sort of making inroads against them, receiving training from the Houthis, according to the UN. And then these two leaders die in mysterious circumstances around the same time. It's just very strange. And, you know, again, if it is true, it comes at the worst time for the group. So good if it is true.
Won't be shocked if it is, I think, is where I stand. Of course, Saif al-Adel, believed to be Al-Qaeda's new leader, sheltering in Iran. Keep in mind, Al-Qaeda hasn't commented on Zawahiri's death 2 years past, right? There's another weird one. We know the reasoning for that. It's embarrassing for the Taliban. Al-Qaeda doesn't want to make the Taliban uncomfortable. And it also draws attention that Saif al-Adel is operating in Iran. So I wouldn't be surprised, even if he is dead, if Khalid al-Adel is dead, that Al-Qaeda wouldn't issue a statement giving his father, the importance of his father, and how it draws attention to Al-Qaeda's network in Iran. So this is why, you know, again, there's conspiracy theories, and then that's an interesting theory. I don't know where I come down on all this, but it all bears watching.
I think that's where I'm at. And on the wider topic, conspiracy theories, is there are sort of batshit conspiracy theories, like the Islamic State attack in Moscow was an inside job by FSB, whereas the Ukraine, that's batshit. Right. This is more of, that could be true, kind of conspiracy theory. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory if there's reason to believe it's possible. It's that impossible, improbable, doesn't make any sense. That, to me, is what makes it conspiracy.
Yeah. Yeah, the Moscow attack being FSB or Ukraine doesn't make a lick of sense either way. This one, there's at least some sort of rationale of why they would want to sort of maybe relieve pressure on Khalid. Maybe they want to relieve pressure on the group itself. Who knows?
Exactly. And last topic, Caleb, recently, in the last couple of weeks, there were some festivities along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. The Pakistanis launched some airstrikes, apparently to target members of the movement of the Taliban in Pakistan, in Paktika and Khost provinces. And the Afghan Taliban, which of course shelters the Pakistani Taliban, while taking support from the Pakistani government. Yeah, go figure all that out. Talk about conspiracy theories, but it's true. They launched attacks of artillery and mortar attacks inside of Pakistan. some acrimonious statements by both sides, particularly by the Afghan Taliban, are saying we'll go to war. And, you know, it was different officials. Some of them clearly had links to Al-Qaeda. So the more fervent guys were like, yeah, let's take the war to Pakistan. And then there was a lot of breathless commentary about how the relationship between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban is over. And, you know, Pakistan didn't get its return in return on its investment in getting the Afghan Taliban to conquer Afghanistan, overthrow the Afghan government. And yet, as I predicted at the time, they will work it out. This is sort of power politics, dare I say, along the border. We saw this sort of thing between the Taliban and Iran. A couple of years ago, I think it was a year ago, over a water dispute, minor clashes along the border, it all goes away. This is the way business is conducted along the borders of Afghanistan, and people just don't seem to understand that. The Pakistani state made a major investment, and look, it suffered over 100,000 casualties by many accounts from 2007 to 2015 during the height of the Pakistani Taliban's insurgency, including suicide attacks in Rawalpindi at the general headquarters of the Pakistani army, Peshawar and Karachi, and, you know, pick your big city in Pakistan, and the Taliban or its allies launched suicide attacks there. It marched within 60 miles of Islamabad in a district called Bunar. And the Pakistani state absorbed all those blows and continued to support the Afghan Taliban. So, Caleb, I know you often defer to me on these issues, but you watch this stuff closely. What are your thoughts on the conflict there? Do you think this is a big deal? What does this say about the relations between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani state?
Yeah, dude, I'm very out of the loop.
I know you watch this.
No, and my main takeaway of, you know, I guess what's happening there is that, you know, TTP is also sort of on the upswing of doing so many attacks against Pakistan. In the last year, you've had like 40 to 50 groups join the TTP. You've seen the Hafez Gul Bahadur group becoming closer with TTP, effectively the same group now. It's just, it's not good. And this is, you know, essentially Pakistan reaping what it sowed. I don't want to be this callous, but Pakistan has sort of brought this on itself, and its people are going to suffer for it.
Caleb, yeah, I say it's the most cynical thing. The Pakistani state holds itself up, and I'm sorry, the Pakistani military. The reason it's able, it has the space to do what it does in Pakistan, it holds itself up as the protector of the Pakistani people. It's the one institution that could protect the Pakistani people, and yet it's willing to sacrifice the Pakistani people for the cynical policy of maintaining strategic depth in Afghanistan. That means keeping India out of Afghanistan. You know, the sooner the Pakistani people realize the greater threat to them is the Pakistani deep state, the Pakistani military that is willing to cynically sacrifice them to the barbarians of both the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban. The sooner this type of nonsense will end, because the Afghan Taliban doesn't exist, the Taliban doesn't exist, and Al-Qaeda doesn't have training camps in 10 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces and safe houses and madrasa in 5 provinces and all of the infrastructure they built without the Pakistani state supporting the Afghan Taliban. So this isn't, you know, this clash that occurred again. I just look at it as, look, is the Pakistani state happy that the Afghan Taliban hasn't reined in the Pakistani Taliban? I'm sure they're not. But it's not, you know, the estimate was that 1,000 Pakistani civilians and soldiers died in fighting last year. Is the Pakistani state going to get upset over 1,000 when 10,000 over the course of about 10 years wasn't enough to sever that relationship? I seriously doubt it.
No. And it might be one of the most callous states right now. And it's, I don't know, his heart always goes out to the civilians who are kind of caught in the crossfire for no good reason. And it's just sad that this is the Pakistani state's, I don't know, policy is to allow its own people to die in the face of having this strategic depth against India.
It is. Look, the Long War Journal has been banned in Pakistan for so long, I forget how many years, but I believe since 2012. Because our reporting on things like this, between links between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani state and the Haqqanis and Al-Qaeda's relationship with the Afghan Taliban and linking it back to the Pakistani state, we're accused of being, you know, anti-Pakistan. Well, I'm not anti-Pakistani civilian. I actually
I'm anti-Pakistan killing its own people.
Yeah, exactly. I have a lot of sympathy. They are the victims. Pakistani civilians are victims of their own state, and it doesn't get any worse than that. You know, we can debate who the greatest state sponsor of terrorism is. It Iran? Is it Pakistan? I always say, you know, I know a lot of people go in the Iran camp, and when you look at what's happening in the Middle East, it's hard to argue against that. I just say flip a coin. They're both equally horrible, both to their own and to the people in the region and beyond.
Well, here's one argument, I guess, on the side of Pakistan. If Iran hasn't had that blowback yet, where you have dozens, if not more, actually way more, because 40 to 50 groups have joined TTP, of just, you know, tens, maybe close to 100 militant groups in your country attacking you. Iran just hasn't had that. So at least, very kind of dark way to think about this,
yeah,
at least Iran is exporting all of this, whereas Pakistan, it's coming back to bite them hard.
Yeah, that's a good point, Caleb. I mean, it's they're so cynical. They just don't care about their own people, which it takes a special kind of evil, in my opinion, to be that way. And again, I'm not rationalizing evil here, but you hit on it, right? In some way, you could understand we're going to export all of this, you know, to point this terrorism at our enemies. Like, again, don't agree with it, but you could see the logic of it. Right.
Yeah, it makes sense from a strategic standpoint. If that was a state policy and that was the only way, I mean, it's one way, the main way that Iran is able to exert its influence is by exporting its ideology, right? At least it's going outward. And it makes sense from a strategic standpoint. Pakistan, it's just, why? Like, what are you actually gaining from this?
Well, and the answer to that is there are segments of the very influential segments within the Pakistani state that are on board with the jihadist ideology. They're on board with what the Taliban is doing. They actually believe in it. It isn't just a strategic depth thing. It's a we're in with the program, and that's what makes it so dangerous. So they intentionally point it inward in order to gain its influence. When Mumbai happened, you had a Pakistani corps commander, like one of the top level generals, come out and say, the wayward Pakistani Taliban, you're our brothers. Let's join together and fight the real enemy, the Indians. That's a very common thought within significant elements within the Pakistan military and intelligence establishment, which is the Pakistani deep state. Any parting thoughts from you, Caleb?
No, I just love that we always end on such a happy note.
Well, you know, we are the bearers of joy in this world,
Caleb.
This is
my curse, dude. I feel like every time I'm on here, it's just we have nothing good to say at the end. And I'm sorry to the listeners. Probably seek therapy, because that probably says more about me than anything else.
Yeah, I'm heading to the pharmacy to pick up my prescriptions after this one in order to sedate myself, because, yeah, there just hasn't been a lot of good news. I mean, maybe Saif al-Hussein did die. I mean, maybe we could take some joy in that. I don't know. But anyway, Caleb, thanks for getting back on. Thanks for talking these issues through. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me back, man. Although I shouldn't be thanking you. Technically, I am a co-host. But thank you.
Let's do it again soon. And thanks to everyone for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again. We'll see you all again real soon.